Thank you very much. By way of introduction, I'm Archie Cox. I'm the chairman of Barclays for the Americas. On behalf of all of us at Barclays, I'd like to welcome all of you here to our third annual Select Industrial Conference, and I think also our best, and also to the luncheon today. One hopes that we will all leave here at the conclusion of this conference with a better idea of what the outlook is for 2011 and beyond as we enter the year with many uncertainties around the world, including in Europe, with the sovereign debt crisis in the Middle East, with the unrest, and in China with some economic uncertainties. At home, we will start the run-up to the election next year with a very large budget deficit, with major foreign policy issues, and with power in Washington shared by two parties with very different approaches, one of which is often itself divided. It will for sure be an interesting year. In any event, you didn't come here to listen to me, but to listen to our keynote speaker. It gives me great pleasure to introduce him, John Rice, Vice Chairman of General Electric and President and CEO of GE Global Growth and Operations, the latter being a position he assumed this January, and I think he's moving this week to, or at least his family is, to Hong Kong. John is to lead the company's global operations with particular emphasis on high-growth markets such as China, India, the Middle East, and Brazil. I suspect he'll be doing a great deal of traveling in the next few years as well. John, please step up, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Archie. Thanks, Archie, and you're right. This is a typical GE move. I've had 13 of them, lived for 10 years in Atlanta, so this is my 13th move, and I have yet to see movers on either end of this transaction. So it's kind of garden variety GE from that perspective. But it's great to be back and to talk about what's going on in our world today, and I'm going to look forward to doing that for 20 minutes or so, and then I'm happy to take your questions after that for as long as Bob will let me. I'll talk a little bit about the environment for the infrastructure businesses, how we see global growth, and some of the aspects of my new role, and then the earnings profile and capital allocation for the company. First, our portfolio and high-level financials, and you've seen charts like this before from us, but in reality, the simplicity of this chart masks the fact that there's a lot of change. And so, you know, when you dig deep, you have a set of infrastructure businesses and a financial service specialty finance business, and that's where we have really concentrated our efforts over the last few years. And as you see from the 2011 outlook, we feel pretty good about where we left 2010 and how we're rolling into 2011. And the story continues to get a little bit better every day. Sorry about that. From an infrastructure environment perspective, this really isn't new news to most of you. We feel really good about emerging market demand really across all of our infrastructure businesses. Starting to see some signs that with the economy rebounding a little bit, there'll be more demand for electricity in the U.S. Our service orders are up in the fourth quarter, and in energy will continue to be challenged a little bit in wind and thermal. Those are long cycle businesses, so we've modeled really an expectation that these will take another 12 to 18 to 24 months to recover, but we'll expect to see some of that next year. In aviation, international passenger travel, cargo, orders up, really pretty good strength across the board. We're continuing to invest in R&D, and we've spent a lot of time over the last few months talking about the importance of our continuing to do that. We've got some extra costs associated with the GENX launch, but as we look at that in comparison with the launch of other major platforms, we're on track or really ahead of where we would have been at a similar point with those efforts. Healthcare left 2010 with a lot of strength, really across the board in most of our major products, in most of our major markets. We've got a pipeline that we've been developing over the last few years that will lead to about 100 product launches over this period. We're doing that in emerging markets. We're doing that in developed countries. We're doing that at lower cost points, and we're doing that in a way that allows us to protect our margin rates. We do watch the national healthcare programs. There is a movement toward austerity. It is an issue in some markets, but the fact of the matter is, when you add it all up, we see continuing strength in our healthcare business, on into 2011 and 2012. And transportation. The demand for freight continues to grow. You see the performance of the railroads. There are fewer locomotives in storage. There's a lot of demand for the service. And we enter 2011 with about 90% of what we need for the year in backlog. So we feel very good about that, and it continues to get better. This is not new news to you either. To do our job and to do it well, we've got to make sure that we're launching great new products. And one of the things that I'm particularly proud of when I reflect on the last 24 months is that we went through a very tough economic cycle and increased our spending on research and development. And that, as you all know, would have been an easy thing for us to cut. But over this two-year period, it's up between 25 and 30% across all of our businesses. So we're continuing to invest where we need to invest to maintain technical leadership, expanding our service portfolio. We've been around for 130 years. The first 115 of those, we were largely equipment with a little bit of service. And in the last 15 years, we've developed these significant service businesses that contribute the majority of our operating profit. The third dimension that we're working on now is related to software and the digital economy and how you can harness the information that comes from being the designer and developer of products like gas turbines and wind turbines and jet engines and locomotives, have the service responsibility for them, so you really understand exactly how they're used in every application and piece all that together in a way that gives you and the customer better information and a better way to manage the life cycle of these products. So for us, it's quite exciting. And you've heard Jeff and Keith say that, you know, on our own, we would be one of the top software companies in the world, about 5,000 software engineers involved in all of our business applications. And that's going to help us, I think, develop a third dimension to our effort that's very exciting. Building leadership in growth markets, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Expanding our core, which is some of what we're talking about related to services. Creating value in specialty finance. The other thing that we're all quite proud of over the last couple of years is that we have a set of financial service businesses that really did everything they said they were going to do. And what we have today is a portfolio that will be a little bit smaller and will be a little smaller still going forward, but one that participates in very attractive business segments where we have great strength in some vertical specialty finance businesses like aviation leasing, like the energy businesses that we think will contribute great value to our customers and great value to our shareholders. And solving problems for customers and society. If you think about, at a high level, we launched EcoImagination, and then 18 months ago, Health Imagination. And these are playing to exactly what the world's looking for in today's environment. Health Imagination, lower cost, better quality, better access. There's not a country that I visit. Canada, Australia, the United States, Europe, the emerging markets, India, China, you name it. The governments that lead those countries are trying to figure out how to solve for those attributes. Lower cost, better quality, better outcomes, and better access. They have to do it. They have to do it or they're going to end up with a disgruntled population. So we've got a way to think about our role in creating enterprise value, and we think it's pretty straightforward, and we think we can execute on it. Our enterprise advantage is around technical leadership. I mean, at the end of the day, the physics of what we do to develop a jet engine that's 15% more efficient than the one it replaces, or a better performing gas turbine, or a larger wind turbine that generates more megawatts is getting harder and harder. Okay, it comes down to having the best technology, and increasingly you can trace that all the way back to material sciences. And one of the advantages we have is because we're involved in so many different disciplines with a world-class global research center that overlays all of these activities, we think we have an opportunity to do this better than most of the companies we compete with. And that's one advantage that we try to exploit. Our global size and scale. So we take this global suite of technologies that really cuts across borders and then drill deep to figure out what applications need to be developed to best serve India, to best serve Indonesia, to best serve China, to best serve Saudi Arabia. And for us, and for me personally, as I think about my new role, it's one of the most important priorities we have. We can't lose the leverage that goes with that global strength, because that's what got us where we are. We have to be more nimble, more agile, more adroit at creating opportunities locally that make sense in China, that make sense in the X-ray market in China, that makes sense in Saudi Arabia, that makes sense in the oil and gas industry in Saudi Arabia. Deep relationships. So we've been doing this for a long time and making sure that we have the right relationships, whether it's the leadership of the country, the leadership of the companies that are our customers there, and all of our other partners, and then a performance culture. So you don't want us doing all of these things without having great leaders who understand risk management and how to allocate capital, ethical business practices, can take things like Lean and Six Sigma and make them work for our customers, satisfy all the quality and regulatory requirements, and achieve true operating excellence. So from a global growth perspective, what we need to do, if you think about one metric that is important to us, or certainly me in this new role, it's to accelerate the growth curve outside the United States. Global growth. We'll do this by re-centralizing decision making, putting more bigger people closer to the point of contact. We're not going to decentralize. We're going to have bigger people closer to our customers making the same decisions that might have been made yesterday in headquarters. We're going to invest in local markets with local players where that makes sense, market-driven product development, which I talked about before, and building key capabilities around our customers. And we think we can bring the GE advantages to all of this and create an equation where 1 + 1 = 3. You know, the growth markets, we segregate them a number of different ways, but one of the ways we look at them is between the resource-rich countries, like those in the Middle East or Russia or Latin America, and rising Asia, which is where the bulk of the population is, some 40% of the world's population between China and India alone, and then ASEAN obviously adds more. I've been asked in this new role if we'll continue to do the company-to-country approach that you've seen from us in the past, and the answer is absolutely, because it continues to pay dividends. And you know, there's lots of examples, but one I'll just describe today is what's happened for us in Nigeria, where 4 years ago, former President Yardua, who has since passed away, called us in because he knew two things. He needed infrastructure in that country, and he wanted to do business with a company that he knew he could count on to do it the right way, in compliance with accepted business practices, and he didn't have to worry about us. The first meeting, we talked about oil and gas and energy, and it was with he and his cabinet. And in that meeting, the Minister of Rail spoke up and said, "I understand this oil and gas and energy stuff, but what about rail? What about trains? I need locomotives." That discussion led to an order 18 months later for 25 locomotives with an option on 75 more. We probably never would have had that opportunity if he hadn't asked us in, brought his cabinet together, and said, "Okay, tell GE what you need and give them a chance to respond. So when you add it all up in Nigeria, where we've had good business for a while, we've probably seen $500 million worth of incremental business from that effort that just comes from the company-to-country approach and the endorsement of the government endorsing our efforts. Do we still have to go in, put the best deal on the table, compete? Nothing's given to us, but it gives us a much better opportunity to do that when we have the leadership's endorsement. India is another proof statement where, you know, we've been in India for a long time. We've had a measure of success, but basically had become a little too complicated with multiple customer touch points, a slower response time than we would like, and not as much depth in our management. We took a senior vice president, John Flannery, put him in India, gave him operating responsibility for the businesses in the country. John has credibility and influence, and you can't understate this enough. You can't overstate it. Just because he's a senior vice president doesn't mean that everybody follows him around. This is a guy with influence. And so late last year when we announced a turbine order with Reliance Electric, if you peel that back and you look at how we ended up winning that order, it's because John worked with the global power and water team led by Steve Bowles to make sure that we had everything we needed to satisfy a very tough customer in Reliance. And you take John out of the equation, and our chances were probably not much better than 50-50. With John in the equation and the right team supporting, the right global team supporting him, our odds go way up. So it really is another way to get the best of being global, because this is global technology, but the local capabilities necessary to satisfy Reliance. Brazil, I don't have to educate this audience about the importance of the Brazilian market. We're doubling down there. We'll put another $500 million in over the next few years, including $100 million to put our fifth global research center in down there. It's a wonderful market for us. We've got world-class customers in aviation, in oil and gas, in the rail business, in the mining business, and the acquisition of Wellstream, which we've announced, gives us an even bigger footprint there because Petrobras is one of their largest customers, a $2 trillion GDP growing at 4%, so there's nothing not to like about Brazil. China, we're trying something a little bit differently in China. We've said we're going to really invest in the Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities. We're doing that a couple of different ways, adding a bunch of commercial resources. We've announced 1,000. We've added 750, most of them in healthcare, and we probably won't stop at 1,000. We've got a number of joint ventures and partnerships underway. I'll talk about a couple of those in a minute. In China, for China, NPI, you're familiar with a number of those. Six new innovation centers. We've announced three. So these are also in Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities. These will be teams of between 100 and 200 people that will include application engineers and scientists to help us innovate products that will start out being for the Chinese market in most cases, but end up being products that we can take globally. So we have a long-term commitment to China. We've been there for a long time, and we think expanding partnerships is the key to it. We'll take a business cut now. We look at our healthcare business in developing markets, where you can see our revenues up between 2005 and 2010 over 50%. 32 new products just for developing markets, including the list that you see on the right, the MRCT and Mac ECG portable equipment, which plays right into that access, cost, and outcome discussion we had about health imagination a few minutes ago. A lot of R&D to make sure that we get the right products. Our healthcare business has put the global head of X-ray for the entire business and based that person in China so that we get a sense for what's going on in the Chinese market, and we can take those ideas globally. Oil and gas, another business that has performed very, very well over the last 5 years. whether it's Australia, where the Gorgon subsea effort continues to get bigger and better, or China, where the West-to-East pipeline continues to deliver for us, Kizomba offshore of Angola, and now Iraq, which a number of companies in the oil and gas space are beginning to get even more interested about. There's enormous reserves in Iraq. I know you all understand that, and it's going to create wonderful opportunities for us. So, you know, we look around the world, and the story is not just about emerging markets, and some people think it is, but the developed countries continue to be very important for us. Just an example of some of the things we're working on in Australia: alloy development, Alzheimer's disease detection, clean coal. In Canada, where we took technology that came out of our global research center, basically the algorithms that allow you to digitize a test slide, a pathology test slide, which is easier said than done, because when you digitize one slide with one tissue sample, it's a 13 gigabyte slide. And you think about all of the slides that get created when you have a biopsy. So we had the technology in the Global Research Center to do that. We joint ventured with the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center to develop the clinical application, and then together we went to the Ontario government to develop this concept of digital pathology. Now, why Ontario? There's other places we could have done this, but the university health system up there is simply world class and has some of the best pathologists around. And you got a country where the ability to access, get this technology up into remote areas is very important. So you have a big concentration of population in Toronto, but you also have a lot of people that live up where, somewhere near the North Pole. And so this is the perfect place to try it and develop the case that then will work in any country that's looking for digital or remote pathological services. So, you know, really good growth and innovation potential in these countries. And, you know, you're looking at two countries which together are worth about $5 billion in revenue for our industrial businesses and have double-digit growth potential. So it's really important not to ignore the developed countries. They are a source for growth, maybe not 30%, but still healthy growth and a real source for innovation. You know, on the supply chain side, really some great stuff. You've heard about the work we're doing in Michigan where, you know, we announced 1,100 jobs and then 6 months later expanded it to 1,300. And the simple reason is that the wonderful people we're getting, I mean, we're getting world-class engineering talent that walks in and contributes from their first day on the job, many of them displaced by, you know, downsizing in the automotive industry. That has proven to be every bit as good as we thought it was going to be, and even better. The work we're going to do in Louisville to bring back refrigerator manufacturing, in Cincinnati, in Waukesha. You know, the U.S. continues to be an important base for us from a manufacturing and a development perspective. We also know we need to localize, and we're doing that in Dammam, Saudi Arabia, which is where the oil and gas industry is located, and Perth, Australia. And then a new concept we're working on, we've started with two energy locations in Haiphong, Vietnam, and Hangzhou, China, what we think of as multimodal facilities. This gives our smaller business units an opportunity to come in under one umbrella. And so energy in this case has taken the lead to develop these facilities. Other businesses will join them. For example, healthcare is now considering doing something in Vietnam because the Vietnamese government's interested in having some small-scale manufacturing done in the country. So having a facility in Haiphong gives us an easy way to do that. The healthcare business by itself wouldn't have enough going on to justify a standalone facility, but as a subset of the energy facility can make that decision quickly, and if it makes sense, go there and start up in a matter of months. And the next country which we'll be working on this concept for is India. So you get kind of the best combination of high-tech investment, localization, and really low-cost, world-class supply chain when we get this right. partnering. You know, the fact of the matter is that, that solving the kind of problems we're trying to solve, pushing the envelopes we're trying to push, will require partnerships. You've heard about all these, I think, on this page, whether it's the a distributed energy strategy in China, the avionics joint venture that we have with AVIC and COMAC for the single-aisle airplane that they're developing, what we announced over the holidays in Russia with RAU UAS in energy and healthcare, and steam turbines in India. These create tremendous market opportunities for us, and they also create jobs in the U.S. We have hundreds of people working in Grand Rapids, engineering, designing stuff for the avionics package that will be on the C919 aircraft in China when it's launched. So we get market access, we create jobs in both places, and we end up doing things that neither us or our partners pictured on this slide could do by ourselves. Now I'll move into a couple of slides, just talk a little bit about capital allocation. You know, one of the other things, I've mentioned a couple of things that we're proud of over the last couple of years, but, you know, the third thing that we're proud of is the fact that we've generated over this two-year period over $30 billion of cash from operations. And if you dial back, you know, 24 or 30 months, there were a lot of skeptics. I won't say some people in this room, but there were a few skeptics when we said, you know, in the first year, we were going to generate $16 billion in cash. There were some people that didn't believe that. We did that and a little bit more. Last year, there were a few skeptics, and we did what we said we were going to do. So we really do feel good about our ability to continue to fuel this company by generating cash from operations and then doing smart things with it. I mean, that's obviously, you can generate the cash. Your expectation of us is that we're going to do smart things with it, and we intend to do that. So we're looking carefully at industrial M&A. We've announced some deals. We think they're really on point strategically and represent good value for shareholders' capital. We're looking, continue to look every month, go through a list of potential acquisition targets, most of them in the $1 billion to $3 billion range. We've announced $5 billion, you know, over the recent period. But the third point, and we're not going to lose sight of the importance of doing things that are shareholder friendly, like enhancing the dividend. We relaunched the buyback, $1.8 billion toward that effort, and retiring the preferred equity this year. So when you sum it all up, we have a lot of hard work in front of us, but we have a lot of optimism about where we are and where we're headed. If you look at kind of headwinds and tailwinds, between 2011 and 2012. The balance in 2011 is clearly in favor of the tailwinds, and I would say, you know, 30 days into the year, things continue to get a little bit better, and the headwinds aren't any more headwind than we thought when we turned the corner. And if you look at 2012, the tailwind list gets a little bit longer, and the headwind list is kind of as we expect. So we feel really great about our prospects and what we have to do in front of us, and very optimistic about the future. So now what I'd like to do is turn it over to you for questions, and I understand that there are mics going to be running around, so raise your hand and one of these people will...
Yeah, two questions. I understand that Saudi is your biggest gas turbine customer, and you probably have a lot of business in general in the Middle East. I just wondered if you could give us your perspective on the what's going on in Egypt.
Sure.
You know, whether you've pulled any people out, what kind of reverberations it might have.
Yep.
Second question is just a specific one on high-speed rail, and I guess Obama announced some big program to build high-speed rail. I think you have a joint venture in China.
Yes.
Can your joint venture bid on that kind of business, or is there made in America type of restrictions that would impede that?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. Yes and yes. The joint venture can bid, but there will be made in America content, which allows us to satisfy those restrictions. So that's one of the things that our association with the Chinese allows us and them to do. We get access to technology which we don't have. They get a U.S. manufacturing platform, and together we create jobs here to go after that business. So it's kind of exactly what you would hope would happen in something like this, where there isn't really a U.S. company with that kind of technology. So we can find it and bring value because we know a little bit about manufacturing in the U.S. So your question about the Middle East, we have pulled all of our people out of Egypt that wanted to come out. We do have local Egyptian employees who, for obvious reasons, want to stay with their families, and we're satisfied that they're not in immediate danger. We shut our offices down. They're working from home to the extent they can do that. So the first thing when something like this happens is safety. And so we spend, like lots of other companies, we spend a lot of time to make sure that we have that in place. I think what's going on in the Middle East, it's alarming when it happens and the way it happens, but it illustrates, frankly, one of the reasons we feel so good about our infrastructure portfolio. Because in the end, what's going on is people are just saying, look, I'm fed up with this wealth disparity. I see the way the rest of the world's living. I can communicate with people in other places. I know I'm not getting what I ought to get. I've been to college. I don't have a job. All of the stuff, right? And if countries aren't making infrastructure investments, they can't close that gap. So over the next 5, 10, 20 years, I think it plays to our strength. It's going to be bumpy. I mean, it's obviously what happened in Tunisia and what's happening in Egypt is hard, and you hate to see injuries and loss of life and all of that stuff. But strategically, it means people are going to have to figure out how to create economic well-being in the people in the 1.5 to 2 billion people that don't have access to the kind of things that you and I have. And that's an opportunity for us. I'm sorry. Yes?
Question over here, John.
Bob.
Yeah, actually a couple of questions. You alluded to when you gave the headwind tailwind to things looking a little bit better. Maybe you could just elaborate on that, whether that's long cycle business looking better, short cycle, U.S., international.
Sure. If you look at our infrastructure business, it's certainly... healthcare is the shortest of our short cycles. We see no reason to think that won't continue to get stronger. The new products we're introducing, some markets may be stronger than others, but we think overall you're going to continue to see strength there. And I know you know this, but the aviation and energy businesses tend to be longer cycle anyways and come out of a downturn at the end. So we really expect that toward the end of this year and into 2011, you'll see more of a bounce in those businesses. And as we kind of get through the challenging parts of the GENX launch, we expect to see some improvements in aviation out beyond 2010. And over time, this economic recovery is going to generate more demand for electricity. A lot of places took a few years off, and there's a little bit of a snapback that comes with that, so we expect that to kick in later on.
John, I had a question relating to the impact of commodity price increases on margins. That's increasingly becoming an issue. And as you look at your businesses, you're obviously in lots of different businesses. I wonder if you could just discuss that issue and if there are any patterns in terms of where you're finding a pretty good ability to pass through and retain margins, whether that be by end market or geography or consumer versus industrial, whatever, or vice versa. Any patterns to that? Thanks.
Well, it's a timely question. I mean, obviously we're seeing pressure, and most companies are. We have factored that into our plan. We expect to see a little margin compression in 2011, and we've built a plan that assumes that. We We challenge our teams to do better than that, so they're all operating on internal plans, which assume that they will, that the cost increases won't be as significant, and they'll be able to pass some of them on. But really, strategically, what we think about are a couple of things. First of all, back to the discussion I had around materials and material sciences, I mean, you got to have options, right? If you are building wind turbines and they're made out of steel, steel goes through cycles and you have deflationary periods and inflationary periods. What are some of the other materials you should be thinking about? Compressed concrete and stuff like that. And those are, you know, at some points, real options. So you have to be thinking about material sciences and other material options. We hedge like everybody else, so that builds in a measure of insulation. And the other thing we do is we have in our long cycle businesses, we have contracts which allow us to push this through in the form of escalation when we see commodity prices go up in a precipitous way. So our goal is to operate as well or better than anybody else out there in terms of the buy part of this and negotiating and where we buy and who we buy and the length of our contracts. And then we have other ways to protect ourselves so that it doesn't show up on our operating statement, or we can limit the impact of it when it does.
Any areas where it's relatively
popular? Geographic areas?
Or land market, or like consumer industrial, or?
You know, not really any that I can think of specifically. I mean, I think the threat is reasonably broad-based. I mean, there's, you know, I read the same stuff you do, and I travel around, and I think it's something that we all need to be thinking about. Yep.
Two of the problems that we see arising in China and around the world are, one is water, the other one is food, and I know you had worked on water very hard. I was wondering where you were in solving problems in water and food.
You know, I think that we've got a great leader in Heiner Markov who's running our water business, and he's been doing it for a couple of years now, and we have really, I think, developed a much better game plan in water. Personally, I think solving for the water equation in places like India and China over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years will determine just how big a water business we and lots of other people have, because it is the limiting factor, right? You can talk about economic growth in many countries and make investments and do all that stuff, but if you don't have clean water for industrial purposes and for individual consumption, then, you know, over the next 25 years, all bets are off. So I really think I look at our water business and I feel great about the way it's performing now. Now the question is, where should we make it big? What should we do to tackle the problems in a place like China or India? And how does that inform us about what we want the rest of the water business to be 10 or 15 years from now? It is a vintage GE business, and it will become bigger and more important, not just in emerging markets. If you do the water scarcity map that places like CSIS or some of these other think tanks do, and you look at 2025 or 2030, there are going to be a lot of issues in a lot of places around water. So, you know, we have great reverse osmosis technology. We have great membrane technology. We have a solid desalination business. All of those technologies work, but you know, the equations that will be required for places like India and China will be different, and we got to figure it out. But it's all upside from my perspective.
You know, a final question from John. I got one. Anybody else have one?
You win.
Okay, I get it. So when you're talking about, you know, global scale, that sort of thing, you know, a lot of talk these days is around the tier B, the second the tier B price points in the emerging markets. And, you know, there's a two-part thought there. One is to penetrate those tier B price points both to accelerate growth and profitability. And the other thing is to make sure in establishing a presence in those tier B markets, you know, you staunch the development of some local competition. So, I mean, what's the, you know, you mentioned healthcare particularly as an example of companies that are, your company has developed low price point X-ray products and thereabouts. But maybe give us a view of the tier B view in emerging markets broadly, both offensive and defensive?
Well, I think what the trap a lot of companies have fallen into, and I think arguably some of our businesses did too over the years, is you start by developing technology for the biggest markets that tend to be the developed markets, and then you defeature or downscale them to work in China or some other place. And what we've learned in the last 5 or 10 years is if you do that, you'll never get there. I mean, you might find a way to get 5 or 10 or 15% of your cost out, but you're not going to get 50% of your cost out. When I showed you the healthcare slide and I talked about those Brevo products, the Brevo CT, those are launched at cost levels that are half of the existing CT product cost levels. So this is a step function change in the way engineering teams think about developing a product. And then if you want to add features and go to markets where they'll pay for those, that's great. It's a heck of a lot easier to add than to take out. And so it really starts with it. You can't do it by downsizing or descaling what you have. You've got to take a clean sheet of paper. So when we launched the V-Scan, which is the handheld ultrasound, the team in Wuxi, China, developed the idea, developed the basic capability. Then they said, well, okay, how do I get the leverage from this global, set of capabilities that we have in ultrasound? And they went to Waukesha, and they went to Europe. They were in Norway, where we also have people that know something about algorithms and transducer technology and all that stuff. And they pieced it together in a way that gave us a competitive advantage. It starts out being a product for China and is a product now for really any market, and is something that we think someday replaces the stethoscope, because it's a lot better to be able to see than hear. So I think that's the model, in a way, that informs a lot of the rest of our businesses about how to do this. To do what we need to do in steam turbine with Triveni, we don't take a Schenectady design and try to smash it into India. We start with a design for India that may be based on some of our technology and some of their technology, and we create a product for India. And I think that's, to me, it's exactly what we talked about when we were talking before about leveraging global technical strengths and bringing a specific market requirement to that capability.
Thanks, John.
Great. Thanks a lot.